The definition you gave of socialism, do you think it's applicable to this world and to this Great Britain? Knowing how we were socialized, family or peer group, through the media and so on. Now, we'd have to re-socialize people to accommodate the way you are defined socially. Not saying I'm not with you, you know, but looking at so many millions of people, would it be very difficult to educate them, knowing who controls the media, both the written media, the electronic media? Wouldn't that be very difficult?
Shall I answer this?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, yes, I agree with you, you know, that it is very difficult. And, you know, I mean, that here we are, you know, just a sort of a handful of us, and, you know, all the others are watching the telly and not really thinking about it. However, people do change. I mean, in spite of what society does to them, they do have a mind and they do think, no doubt about it. And a lot of the forces today in capitalism pushes people into thinking for themselves. If you think of the jobs that people have to do today, there are many more jobs where you really have to think for yourself and be original and look after yourself and, you know, be flexible. You've got to be able to change jobs all the time. So you have to, the system itself encourages people to develop a sort of personality where they have to think. And what socialism is about, you see, it's about realizing what's in your own interest. Now, that's a natural thing for people to do. You know, people want to have what's in their own interest. You know, I'm not advocating socialism for the interest of other people. I know it's in my interest and also in the interest of other people. So with these two things, you know, that we bear in mind, and the fact that the system itself is forcing us to change all the time so that there is no one source of authority, as there used to be, you know, religion or even politicians. I mean, now we see authority as coming from all kinds of different sources, and therefore it's less strong than it used to be. So although I do agree with you that it's a tremendous struggle against the media, you know, we have no access to the media, I still think that, you know, people will use their minds for themselves. I hope they will.
State capitalist countries, don't you, where there's a small group takes power and they set themselves the task of educating everyone and, well, using propaganda to fool them into thinking that they've got something worth having. And that's obviously not the way that's not our definition of socialism. The only way socialism can come about, as far as the SPGB are concerned, is everyone consciously wanting it, not a small minority.
If I could come in on this, though, because I think it also follows on from this. As I understand it, you're suggesting that socialism can't actually be achieved by the use of the methods of terrorists, be they state terrorists or individual groups. But you also seem to be suggesting it's possible to achieve socialism without actually using violent means. And I just wondered what you would do, because the minority of people who already have power are obviously going to resist you to the hilt. Even if you start trying, not through trying to get support and acting as leaders yourselves, but through educating people, they're not going to like that either. If you seem to be having any effect and people are actually listening to you, then they're still going to use repression against you. So what would be the reaction to that? If you're not prepared to use violence yourself?
Well, what you've got to think is that the revolution for socialism would be a revolution, a majority revolution. So it would not be a minority attacking the state who could be, you know, repressed by the state. It would be the majority of us, something like 80 or 90% of us. Now, 80 or 90% of us would mean that a great deal of people in the army and in the police force would already agree with socialism. And of course they would, because they're workers, just like you and I. So, I mean, so then the people in power, I mean, the government and the people who own everything, just would not have their weapons, because the police and the army would not be working for them anymore. They wouldn't agree with them. Think, for instance, of what happened in Iran fairly recently. Like, the Shah had the strongest army possibly in the world, and, you know, it was really sort of... Well, and then overnight it went over to somebody else. So, you know, political power is a tenuous thing. I mean, even another minority can threaten it. So the majority of the people, having all come, you know, rationally to deciding what they want, would just do it, and they would vote. You see, we've got the vote in this country, and all the Western democracies have the vote, and that you would just put your little bit of paper, and on it, there wouldn't be a name, well, there might be a delegate's name, but basically there would be written World Socialism.
Well, that's very fine to get out of that way. You draw the analogy with Shaw, some of the things like that. Now, could look at the opposite side of that. Could look at Poland and Solidarity,
yeah,
where the majority wanted this thing.
Yeah.
Who could control that? It was he had weapons. He controlled all of that. Although even some of the military force was even with Solidarity.
Yeah.
It couldn't come out of that thing.
Yeah, well, I'll just say a word. Yeah, can I just say a word and then Ron can speak? Just one word is that, you see, the people in Solidarity were not after changing society.
No.
You see, they just wanted certain little things changed in it. So they weren't, it was not a matter of revolutionizing society at all. It was a conflict over wages, and in those sorts of conflicts, the state wins. But, you know, other people might want to say something on this.
Well, maybe I could look at that Polish thing again. Part of the trouble with Solidarity, there seems to me to be one little thing that's rather similar with the miners at the moment. Do you think the miners can win? I'm not certain myself. I'm not certain that what they're asking is even feasible for British capitalism to give them. Now, I may be right, I may be wrong. Well, I see the same sort of thing with Solidarity. Solidarity were really asking for, out of Polish state capitalism, something that it probably couldn't deliver. Now, half of the population, you say they were in the majority. I deny they were in the majority. They were a very large minority, don't you that? But the majority of the Polish population were still with the state. And that's why Solidarity didn't succeed. Didn't take power. But if it had taken power, as some coups like this have done, they have found out the realities of capitalism. Capitalism works in particular ways with the world markets, with the International Monetary Fund and all the rest of it. Poland was heavily in debt to the West and so on. They would have come up against exactly the same realities. And they would have screwed the workers in exactly the same way to get that profit to pay those bankers. So it's capitalism which is the trouble in the end, not whether people have got these intentions or the other.
Now, one of the things that Christine didn't spend much time on was that most of these terrorists have been imitating capitalist revolutions of the past. The Russian capitalist revolution didn't happen until 1917. The Chinese capitalist revolution didn't really happen until 1948. Now, that seems so recent, they're using terms that Marx used. Britain's capitalist revolution took place in 1648, 300 years before. So we tend to have forgotten that we had a revolution. We pretend we didn't have one. We're all respectable. We don't have things like revolutions in this country. One of the bloodiest revolutions you can imagine. Cromwell. The French had their revolution. 1789, 1792. Bloody again. Capitalism is always bloody when it comes in. You can look at it striding across the world. Now, for God's sake, don't say that a socialist revolution is going to be like a capitalist revolution. It's going to be nothing like it. There has not yet been a socialist revolution in the world. But when it comes, it's going to be quite different from capitalism. It's going to be all of us, virtually. And the capitalist class are just going to quietly pack up their banks and go, because there is nothing they can do about it. No violence will make any difference to 90% of the population. Nothing. Once we all decide that, that's a question of making socialists. And that's the game we're in. We're trying to persuade you. What we say is both right and it's urgent. And if you agree with us, you've got to start working with us.
I think as regards Solidarity and so on, that, as Ron said, they were a trade union. And within the membership of Solidarity, there were various people who saw a certain solution, say Western-style capitalism, as a to solve the Polish problems. Others who saw maybe a modified form of Soviet capitalism or Polish capitalism and so on. So all this, these different aims over and above their trade union aim, and so they weren't really very united on political issues. And therefore it was easy, I mean, apart from the sheer force of martial law, it was then relatively easy for them to divide people and cut away the support and from solidarity after martial law.
How many years do you expect, or do you have any time scale when you expect people to oppress minorities in countries suffer for them to achieve your utopian socialism?
I'm not a prophet, you know. No, there's no way of telling. There's absolutely no way. You see, what all that one can say is that because of the media and the you know, modern communications, is that when an idea takes, it spreads extremely quickly. You know, just think, for instance, that if I describe to my grandmother, for instance, how women would live today, she wouldn't have believed me. You know, she would have thought that was impossible. You know, women going around the world on their own, travelling, having jobs, earning their own money, you know, looking after themselves, having children. It would have been the same sort of reaction, you know. I mean, she might not have thought that was utopia, but she would have said, no, out of the question. And if you think of, you know, all kinds of ideas have been minority ideas to begin with. Think of, you know, Leonardo da Vinci in the 15th century drawing planes on pieces of paper. You know, that was another utopia. People flying, you know, impossible. But the difference, you see, between utopia and in the sense that you mean and what we're describing, the difference is that utopia is a fantasy. It's something like, you know, you sort of could imagine, you know, society on the moon or something, or, you know, something like that. Something completely impossible. But what we're talking about is not impossible at all. What it needs is work. Like the planes of Leonardo da Vinci, it needed a certain amount of technology and people to work on the ideas and people to work on the materials, and then it becomes real. It's exactly the same for socialism. It's an entire matter of human beings working on it. Working on that particular idea, and then they can make it work. I mean, that's what I think.
For you to have the liberties that women have today, that was brought about by violent reaction and action by women over the past 100 years.
Oh, well, not violent actions, no.
And it's a continuation of violence now that is gaining the liberation and freedom, especially for women.
Well, I'm violent, me. No, it wasn't, no. And anyway, that was just, I'm not comparing the two. All I was saying, I was only using that example to show that ideas can change quickly over one or two generations. That's all. I didn't mean, you know, the two were related. I just meant that ideas can change very quickly today. You know, that one generation of children is brought up today in a very different way to the generation just before. Whereas in the past, it used to take generations and generations for things to change, you know, very slowly. So that's all I'm saying. Things go quickly today. So this idea could go quickly.
Yeah,
I think the reason for that is the sort of technology we've got. I mean, messages can be flashed across the world overnight.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
100 years ago.
That's right.
You know,
exactly.
This is why it can change the quick today.
But our friend asked a question about oppressed minorities as well, didn't he? Which I think we lost sight of a little bit.
That was in your list. Isn't violence a legitimate means of expression for these people? You get their...
Well, legitimate is an emotion word. That means that's something I agree with. That's all it means in that particular context. So, the question you really should be asking, is it efficient or effective?
Yeah.
Now then, in the talk,
well,
you know, Christine pointed to some cases of insurgent terrorism which have succeeded, and some will. By and large, they don't. Now, presumably, again, I'm picking on your accent, presumably you're thinking of the problems in Ireland. And I would think that the odds on violence succeeding, say, with the Catholic minority in Ulster, would be pretty small. I think that the odds stacked against them are pretty huge. Now, I wouldn't think that so much if there weren't such a body of anti-Catholicism, I won't call it Protestantism, anti-Catholicism in the Northern Ireland population, as well as in government, not simply government forces. You've got a total lack of unanimity amongst the working class there. Now, if you've got a united working class, this is a utopia, if the working class of Ulster or Northern Ireland were united in the rest of the world, then they could achieve something. But they're not united, as I say. And of course, it is a utopia to expect them to be united in one country and not in any others. But the thing is, what we often say about the revolution is, stop knocking on the baker's door and say, give us some bread. Stand outside in a massive phalanx and say, right, we're coming in to take the shop. And then watch how fast he throws bread out. That's the difference, I think, in the case. You're asking for justice for an oppressed minority. Not only the minority are oppressed, they're all oppressed, but some are oppressed more than others, I think.
Like women.
Christine was giving an example of change over a generation, say, women's rights and so on, but a friend at the back was talking about, say, solidarity, that wasn't change over a generation, that was change over a
few weeks,
whatever, a couple of months, and people saying to, like, Varane, say, you're an idiot, there's no way you can change anything. Well, they did. And then the state moved in to stop that, using its own form of terrorism.
But even in the case of these remember states, or in the case of these, what states are it? Saying that these are very traditional to society. What is, think of the people, they're locked there, right? Okay, that's another question I'm going to ask. What methods are you planning to use to propagate your ideas of socialism?
Oh, well, what we do now, we work as hard as we can. As we said, we haven't got access to the media, and so that's a very powerful, that's a very big drawback. In fact, when you think of it, when you think of the idea of freedom of speech, we've got freedom of speech in this country. Well, we've got freedom of speech. We can all be here talking. But freedom of speech today would mean access to the media. That's what it would mean. Because when in the 19th century, for instance, and before, really the audience you could reach was the audience that you could reach, that the range of the human voice could reach, right? So if you had freedom of speech then, that was really, really quality, but you didn't have it then, or not much of it anyway. People getting up on a sort of soapbox and speaking. But today it's ridiculous to talk of freedom of speech when, I can sort of reach, 40 people, but, anybody in government or anybody, who's got access to the media can reach millions and millions of the world. So there's no freedom of speech. So I agree with it. It's very difficult, and we've got to work, but there's nothing else to do. So what do? We organise meetings, we sell our literature, we go around and talk to people. It seems very limited, but, the main hope is, for me, anyway, maybe that this is my own personal view, but my main hope is that I think human beings all have a mind, and that mind they will use. They will use it eventually without me going around to tell them how to use it, because it's not my business anyway. They will use it, they will look around, and they will see that's not right. Why are things like that? Why are people dying in hunger and there are mountains of food everywhere else? And we're paying farmers not to produce, and yet, some people need it. Houses are empty, and yet people are housed. People will see. They will look at the system and come to their own conclusions. That's how it will come about. Not by people being forced into it, by people using their mind. That's how I think. But,
not just
forced,
but don't you think you need to mobilize people? Very rarely, you sit down at your home and you realize that things are short and this and that and that. And you sit down at your home. You can't stand your home. You need a group, you need a body.
Yeah.
Now, would you have some plans of mobilizing people?
Can I just say one thing? As far as we're concerned, the only real understanding is powerful. It needs real understanding. It's no good people following a slogan and then suddenly finding halfway down the road they're not quite sure how their slogan tells them to behave in this context. They've got to know what they're doing. But you make two socialists. Let me make two socialists. Each one of those make two socialists. And each one of those make two socialists. You watch the rate at which that can grow.
if you can make socialists. Now, they all say what you're saying.
Yeah, but how are you going to get the others? Don't bother about me. How are you going to get the others to do it?
Everybody's saying that. People want great people. That anymore. If we each make, if we each double ourselves and another two socialists and another each one of those, that we should be the thousands in a year. Which is a work attitude.
Absolutely, Roger. If everybody in this meeting tonight went away and converted one person, twice as many next week, you think, multiplying the numbers at that rate, how many people would turn up in 1 year's time? The building would not be big enough. That's how quick socialism could grow, by each person only converting one person.
I think converting is the wrong word there. Convincing.
Or convincing.
Yeah. I think I'd like to say that I slightly disagree with Ron's use of to make socialists. I mean, I don't, you know, like, I'm here tonight to talk. I'm here tonight to just say what I think. If some of you went out of the room thinking about it and became socialists, you know, later, I wouldn't consider that it was my doing at all. I wouldn't consider I'd made anybody a socialist. I just said what I thought. Then it's up to people to think for themselves. You know, it's up, not up to me to make anybody or, you know, even less convert anybody. It's really up to you, you know, to think it out, to look at, you know, to think, well, is that a good idea? You know, would socialism be a good idea? Would it be a good society to be in, yes or no? Well, you know, if it is it a good idea for me to work at that? Or is there something better than I can do? Well, my own attitude was, for a long time, that working at socialism was not sort of active enough, you know, and so I didn't join for many years, although I was aware, you know, I knew people in the party. And then, you know, ultimately I realised, well, there's nothing else I can do, because if I join any other organisation or start doing anything else, it's not going to lead me to what I want. So I'd rather at least be doing what's going to lead me to what I want, even if, you know, I don't know when I'm going to get there. At least I'm doing the thing that's really right for me. That's how I look at it personally. I mean, we may all have different ways, you know, reasons for being in this and working at this.
Is there a definite definition for socialism? Because over the years, I've read many different brands, I've seen many different brands of socialism, or so-called socialism.
Yeah.
Is there a definite definition for socialism?
Well, we've got
everybody seems to give them.
We put it on all our literature.
I've never seen a literature. Personal definition of what we or they think socialism is.
Well, you see, socialism basically, I described it before, it wasn't exactly a definition, but socialism basically is a moneyless and wageless society where people cooperate, you know, just get together, work and produce what they need and take what they need. That's basically what it is. And you see, it's not, I mean, somebody said it was a utopia, but if you think that, if you think of all the human beings that have been on the earth, right, sort of for, let's say, 1 million or 2 million years, something like that, well then, this is from a book now, I'm just remembering remembering the figures right, 90% of human beings have lived in hunter-gatherer types of society, which are much more like socialism than we are, much, much more like it, although, you know, they're not exactly socialism. 90% of human beings. Now, what was it? 6% have lived as farmers and 4% as industrial working, you know, people like ourselves today. So, you know, 90% of human beings have actually lived in the sort of society I'm describing, that is society where people just work together, get what they need, make what they need, and live, you know, just live. I mean, we've just completely forgotten that, what life is about living.
Well, that takes us back to the barter system, because you said earlier on about a moneyless society,
yeah,
which I quickly run to my mind and see that it's impossible now in today's world, because most is only two countries that really can produce all the things that is Russia and the States, can really produce all the material that they need.
Yeah.
Without even trading outside. Now, a country like Britain, a so-called industrialized country, would depend on everything to come in. Can we have that work among the society? No.
Sorry?
I was asking, can that among the society work?
Well, I got the point, if I may take it.
Maybe that's the wrong thing when you said moneyless society.
No, no, I mean moneyless society, yes.
You said a moneyless society?
Yeah. Well, if it, I'm not quite with you, Ron. If you,
well,
if you...
I'll put this question to you. The question is, what about international trade? Because some countries depend upon it.
Yeah, well, this is why, you see, this is why we say that socialism would have to be a world society. Because exactly, you couldn't have some countries that were capitalist and still trading and having money exchanges and all that, and some that weren't, the others would be lost. It can only work if the whole world decides to be like that. And then, you see, then, well, each country will produce what is right for them to produce, what they can produce. African countries would probably, you know, I've read things recently in the New Scientist or somewhere that some African countries could feed the world if they were, if this, you know, they were exploited properly, which they aren't today. So what would happen is that just people would work and produce all the things that they can produce. Perhaps in England we would produce more in the way of solid goods than food, you know, but we still could produce quite a bit of food, and others would produce other things. Then we would just, like today, exchange the things, you know, give what we can, what we've got to give, they would give what they've got to give, and people would just take what they need. I mean, when you think of the computers that we've got today, it wouldn't be very difficult to arrange, you know, knowing the needs of different, you know, groups and localities and whatnot, and arranging, you know, for these needs to be met. But not through money, just through need.
Who do you set up to say how much a bag of corn is worth? How many bags of corn is worth a computer?
Well, no, you don't, you see. You don't.
There's no exchange. I mean, worth, you're talking about value. Well, value is only something that's socially created. Money is only money because we all agree that it's money. If we say money doesn't mean anything, it's just a bit of paper, it's nothing. And you're saying, what's a computer worth? A computer is a computer. That's all it is. It's nothing else. It's not worth it.
It's worth no more than its usefulness.
You get the idea of value when somebody owns it. Some specific individual or small group of individuals own it. But without that, when it belongs to everybody, then that idea of value doesn't come into it. Only its use value. You're talking about an exchange value, and that does depend upon property. We're talking about a society in which all the production units and distribution units belong to the whole of society, in the same way as the land used to belong to everybody.
Yeah, I think I'd like to come back to that. I think... maybe what you're worried about is how, you know, what people would get then. You know, some people might seem to get more than others or whatever, and you think that it should be measured somehow. But you see, the idea of socialism, I mean, the reason why socialism would really be possible today, more so than it's probably ever been possible in the past, is that we can produce an abundance of things today. In fact, we do produce an abundance of things, except we don't have access to it. If you can produce an abundance of things, then you don't need to exchange, you don't need to measure. People just take what they need from the abundance. And in fact, I was reading a book recently called Humankind by a chap called Peter Farb, and he was describing these hunter-gatherer societies, and he said that they use nature, they use the abundance in nature as a sort of natural larder, and they all help themselves to just what they needed. And what I think, you see, is that today we have recreated that sort of abundance, that sort of natural, well, it's not natural, it's man-made or woman-made as well today, both. And we have this abundance, and it's there, and we could revert not to living like people lived in the forest, because we wouldn't want to, but to living socially in that way, that is to have all the abundance there, not just on the trees and the bushes, but in shops, well, not shops, but in places, you know, in buildings. Just take what we need. And everybody would do the same, and everybody would produce as well. And it would be rich, you know, it would really solve so many of the problems that we've got. It wouldn't solve all problems, but it would solve so many. It would solve war, it would solve hunger, it would solve poverty, it would solve competition. You know, it would just, you know, and we would be different people. I mean, we wouldn't be so stressed all the time for fear of lacking and for fear of, you know, and we wouldn't have to measure ourselves either. I mean, we spend a lot of time measuring ourselves today. You know, I'm worth this and that, diplomas, money, cars, you know. That would go as well. You know, we'd be just free people. Think of that.
I think if you think in terms of how many people waste it as well.
Yeah.
Just taking care of money, watching going for money, distributing money.
Yeah.
All the different types of activity that would no longer be required, like banks and building societies and anything to do with money, all those people would be released to carry out use of work. So the question hasn't come up about laziness or idleness, how many people would want to do anything. I've thought about this quite a lot, and although I wouldn't like to put a figure on it, we could carry as a society a very large percentage of bona fide people who wish to stay in bed 23 and 3/4 hours every day and still be a more efficient society than what we are now, because of the amount of people that are tied up doing nothing.
Just before your question,
getting back to terrorism, I mean, I'm not advocating or defending it, but I really can't agree when you say that violent struggle has achieved nothing. I mean, there are hundreds of examples. You mentioned Iran, Nicaragua, Vietnam, hundreds of examples in this country's history, Ireland, India, Eden, where violence has achieved something, for better or worse. Often worse, but...
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very important
device
out there.
Yeah. No, I mean,
you can't tell me to the shop.
Yes, I know what you mean.
Off.
Yes,
I know.
Yeah.
Should have got out of Vietnam.
Yeah, I know.
India.
But I did say that when it was a matter of gaining power, it did work in sort of unstable societies, and that's what happened through history. A society has become slightly unstable because, you know, its sort of economic situation was no longer sort of right for, you know, the way it was organized, and that causes instability. And then indeed a new group of people senses that and comes up and takes power, and that minority takes power violently. And I think I did say that worked. I mean, when I said it hasn't really achieved anything, I was talking as a socialist. You know, it hasn't achieved... Well, they haven't... Well, no, it's not actually true, because they said... I mean, most of these rival minorities do say that they're going to achieve a better society, more equal, better for the people and all that, and they do not achieve that. So it is true that they don't achieve what they set out to achieve.
No, they don't achieve a perfect society, but you said that the Vietnamese are worse off without the Americans, or the...
Well, you know, it's always the same. When you've got rulers... When you accept situations where you're going to have rulers, you know, sometimes you're going to have a slightly better ruler, sometimes one who's not so nice.
Yeah.
It was exactly the same with the slaves in America. Some slaves happened to have, you know, really dreadful masters who just beat them up until they died, you know, used them to sort of decided, well, these will sort of do for about 20 years, you know, just beat them up, and after 20 years they just die. And that's it. Other masters, you know, happened to be different, had different ideas, maybe were a bit guilty, God knows what, treated their slaves quite well.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, they were slaves. What, you know, they were slaves. So what I'm talking about is a society where we would all stop being slaves. I mean, today we're slaves.
Yeah, but it's still improvement. I mean, say, like Somoza, do you think the Nicaraguans are better off? Now, what do they expect them to do? Wait till by some binary fusion everyone becomes a socialist, and then Somoza's going to pack his bags? It was only after years of violent struggle and riots. I know it's not perfect there now, but at least it's an improvement.
I must take issue with this. You are talking as though these were people's movements, and I really think you've been led up the garden path if you think so. Because this is the age-old story of the violent minority wanting to overthrow another. We are the people's champions. Follow us. It's happened so many times. Now, I'm not saying that the conditions are never any better, but by and large, the real motive for those slogans is to get a fighting force to enable them to take power. I don't know about the individual cases in middle America at the moment, because trying to get the truth out of there is quite a difficult business. But, I mean, look at the Russian peasants. I suppose the average Russian worker today is somewhat better off than the average Russian peasant 60, 70, 80 years ago. Nevertheless, I mean, simple industrialization would have done some of that anyway, because you couldn't have run industry under the old Russian serfs. But look at the number of bloody dives.
Now, that was supposed to be their utopia. And you could pick countless examples. So I think that you are tending to accept as people's movements things which are really not people's movements. I mean, I think the numbers of cases in the African states, like, I'm not going to think of his name now, Lumumba was one, but I'm trying to think of the chap in Ghana. Oops, there you go. But, you know, again, turn around on...
Terry Wallace?
Jager. Which one?
Jager. J-A-G-E-R.
Young.
No, not
Guyana, I'm sorry, Ghana.
Oh, Ghana.
Anyway, it doesn't matter particularly, but all I mean to illustrate generally is that these people who get to power on the back of a peasantry or a working class stay on their backs.
It's true that Nicaragua, with it's Borge, isn't it, who came to, I don't know how to pronounce it, Borge or Borge, or who sort of took over in
Sandinistas.
That's right. But Nicaragua is an exception, isn't it, in Latin America? In fact, it's possibly the only state where the terrorists have actually taken power and then established something much more like, let's say, a Western democracy. It's not a Western democracy. I mean, I'm not even sure that they've got the vote. But, you know, they have got the vote. Yeah, but, I mean, you know, I'm not sure they've got, you know, sort of what sort of vote, you know. But anyway, I agree there that Nicaragua has probably meant some sort of improvement for the people who live there. However, you know, one has to, you know, sort of... I know what you mean, that you have to rejoice in a way. I mean, you know, a number of people are better off, they're not living under terror anymore, and they've got lives that are more worth living than today. But still, you see, the people who take power, even if they are kinder rulers, the main reason why they're doing it, and I mean, one can't help looking at motivations, the main reason why they're doing it is because, clearly, it is more efficient to have a working class that does not live in very poor conditions and that is not terrorized all the time. A working class like that works better, produces more profit, and is just generally, it's more in the interest of the government to do that. And so the governments are just, you know, taking the power, and they decide, you know, they sort of decide, well, we're going to do this to our working class, we're going to feed them better, clothe them better, give them more incentive to be alive and sort of happy and look after themselves and all that. And the system, capitalism, will then work better. And that's true. And that is the motivation.
It doesn't always mean it'll stay like that, anyway.
And no, it doesn't.
I mean,
we've
had better times in this country, and things have got worse, and they're getting worse, you know, and conditions of living. So there's no reason, there's no guarantee that once they've got certain conditions, that there's not going to be any regret.
Chile is another kind of way,
Can I bring that point, though, isn't it? I mean, perhaps the Sandinistas do believe that, perhaps the Sandinistas have done it to... Help the people, and
that's
just making profit-making machines.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I think that I agree with the idea of the fact, if you like, that a lot of people who are involved in movements like that, just as I think a lot of people who are in the Labour Party in this country, do really think that that they're working for improvement of conditions and for a better society and a more equal society. That's true. But nevertheless, the small minority of people who own the country and who own the land and the factories and everything, they're just using these sincere people. They're just using them. And ultimately, I have sympathy for them, obviously. I know they're doing something that they think is right and they think is good, and if they can see some improvement, then they feel they've achieved something, whereas, you know, I've achieved nothing. You know, I'm here... and I've not achieved socialism, so I know what you're saying. But still, it's still capitalism, and capitalism will go on working in the way it does, and there will never be any security for anybody under capitalism. You know, things can change, and even when you live in a reasonably advanced country like this one, you know, not in Latin America, you know, you can go on strike because you can lose your job and all that, and the police will come and break the strike. And basically, all I'm saying is that we've got to go further than all these other things, and we've got to to change the whole system, because as long as we keep the profit system, we'll keep all the problems that go with it in you know, one part of the world or another. They'll be there. They'll crop up all the time. Not because of people, you see. I'm not attacking people. Because of the system.
Stop going for the crumbs and go for the bakery. Change the lot.
Do you want to come in with your partner?
In a socialist society, how would we cope with greed, personal ambition, and the individual's lust for power?
The individual's
lust for power to control other people.
Well, do you think that's part of human beings?
It's human nature.
Well, what makes you say that?
Because it's got us to where we are today. Greed, lust for power.
Well, How has it got us where we are today?
Well, I can't really go into that much time, but it seems pretty obvious.
Well, I don't know, you see.
Yeah,
I mean,
Christian is already human nature, it never changes. I mean, you're assuming that there is a human nature, and that's what motivates people. Socialists generally tend to think that in a socialist society, people wouldn't have the same motivation. There would be no need to be greedy. I mean, say for instance, if you could take what you wanted, what you needed, you would take what you needed. So, say you smoked, you wouldn't take 20,000 packets of tobacco a day. I mean, it would be pointless. You wouldn't be able to sell them to anybody because anybody else would get what they want. It's a pointless situation. So the environment affects the way people think, it affects people's motivation. So
people become more complacent?
Not necessarily
grieving individuals.
I'll let Pete come in after this. But
yeah, I think Christine has already dealt with partly earlier on when she referred to various primitive communist societies, which probably took quite recently existed in many parts of the world. But as capitalism has spread, it's now more kind of exterminate them or extinguish them. And in these primitive communist societies, I mean, they're using these features of behaviours which you just referred to, this cross-cut power and such. In fact, quite on the contrary. And even today, you still got a small community in the MIS called Zanskar. Now, this society has succeeded in remaining cut off from the mainstream of capitalist civilisation. And there, in society, even today, I mean, no war courts, no wars, they have a word for war in fact in their language, they have no greed. But there's been a couple of the documentaries quite good until written about society. So here you have an empirical example, you know, which seems to refute the idea that man is naturally greedy, lust of power, etc. So if you want, you know, hard, concrete, empirical example, you know, if you're not kind of satisfied with all your theoretical arguments, things like it, there you've got an example in today in the MLAs.
There are plenty of such examples too, aren't there? You could, for instance, South American Indians.
The Pinar Indians. I think you have a type of the Pinar Indians.
But that's not to say that socialism is some sort of primitive society.
No, it's still going to bring this technological advancement. Yeah.
What's the connection between technology and greed?
I was just using technological advancements as an example.
Why do you need
greed? Why do we need an advancement of any sort?
No, why would greed cause a problem? I just think
greed motivates.
Well, it does. No, it does. If you've got, if it's like we said before that. If you're in a situation where there's a scarcity of cigarettes or something and someone says to you, oh, you know, help yourself, you're going to make sure you get a lifetime supply.
Short lifetime.
Or whatever it is. Because you know that next week, that offer, I mean, because you're in this society, that offer won't be on again, so you've got to make sure you get it. Right? If you knew that next week, you could still go along to the shop and get your packet of cigarettes.
I think you're getting confused with what you're saying.
You wouldn't be greedy in that sense. You'd say, well, I know that's going to be okay. It's like taking water from the tap. You don't say, well, I'll put it as much as I can, because it might not. Because you know that next week, next month, next year, provided you pay your water rates, that water is still going to be there.
Yeah.
I think you're getting confused with what you see in a capitalist society.
all around you in this country. Certainly greed motivates people in a capitalist society because you're somebody if you accumulate. You're somebody if you're powerful in a capitalist sense. It certainly motivates people in this society, but it certainly wouldn't play any part in the socialist society because people would be generally equal.
Yeah, but you see, I think that even today, most people are not really motivated by greed. I mean, that's the interesting thing. A minority of people are. But if you think of an event like the Olympic Games, for instance, that we've just had, well, an event like that couldn't work if people were motivated by greed, because all the ones who were sure that they wouldn't get gold medals wouldn't go. Right? No, but it's true. And you see, most of the activities that go on in capitalist society go on for the sake of one or two winners. Same for all the tennis tournaments. You know virtually that you've got no chance. And yet they all enter. And let alone people who go to the Olympics, but people have, you know, sort of are motivated to go to sporting events all over the country just for their own pleasure. Because human beings, basically, without needing to win a gold medal every time, enjoy being active physically, mentally, emotionally. But now, today in capitalism, they're greatly frustrated in that part because they've got to work 8 or 9 hours a day at something completely useless, and partly because they're generally pushed into being competitive rather than just do what they want. But I'd like to say something else about a tendency that I think each period in time has of thinking that it's the peculiar characteristics that come out in people at that particular time are just human nature. And I mean, this relates to the talk because it's about violence today, because our society of, you know, advanced capitalism is so violent, you know, it pushes us to violence so much that we tend to think human beings are just violent. You know, it's everywhere. Football matches, in the street, in the pub, wars, terrorism, it's just all over the place. And so we assume that people are violent. And I'll just read you two or three quotes I've got here. One is from the Penguin History of the World by J.M. Robert. And he says this. It's a very good book, but this is what he says. Nonetheless, at the very beginning, nonetheless, he's just studied the prehistoric times. He says, nonetheless, though much of the just prehistoric world must have been lawless and violent, must have been, it is worth remembering that there was an offsetting factor. The world was still not very full. The replacement of hunter-gatherers by farmers did not have to be a violent process. The ample space and thin populations of Europe on the eve of the introduction of farming, for example, probably explain the lack of archaeological evidence of violent struggle. So you get someone like him, a scientist, a historian, total lack of any archaeological violence, of violence, and yet, he says, the just prehistoric world must have been lawless and violent. And you see, that's how we think. And another really interesting example is there was this anthropologist called Raymond Dart, and he found a skeleton called the Torn Baby in 1942. Anyway, then he found various smashed baboon skulls in a particular situation. I could go more into details, but it's not very interesting. Anyway, he came to the conclusion that these baboon skulls had been killed by this Australopithecus, which is our ancestor, you know, we are now told. Right. The next step after deciding that, without any evidence, was to find a weapon. So he couldn't find a weapon, so he invented one. He decided that the weapon was a bone that this Australopithecus used to smash baboons on the left side every time they walked into this cave. Yeah, but you see, it's not funny, because wait now. What he wrote was this. According to Dart, the Macapansgat hominid, forgive the pronunciation, was a brutal little fellow who survived in a hard world only because of his murderous instincts developed by his dependence on weapons. He wrote, this is Dart, Australopithecus lived a grim life. He ruthlessly killed fellow Australopithecines and fed upon them as he would any other beast, young or old. He was a flesh eater and as such had to seize his food when he could and protect it night and day from other carnivorous marauders. To justify, end of what Dart wrote, to justify this picture of a ferocious weapon-wielding little killer, weapons had to be found. Dart sought stone ones in vain for years, never finding a single one. So he invented some, which today is an embarrassment to anthropologists, because he was also very good at other things, such as finding, you know, human skulls. Then, but this is where it stops being funny, because then he met a bloke called Robert Ardrey, which, you know, you may have heard of. And this chap, Robert Ardrey, then wrote a bestseller called African Genesis. And that bestseller really promotes the idea of the killer ape, you know, who is our ancestor. Later on, they found the explanation for these baboon skulls, because they had two punctures, all of them exactly at the same sort of interval, and it was then found out that these fitted exactly the leopard tooth gap. And so it's now an accepted explanation that that was what happened. The leopards would be on a branch just above the cave and just seize the baboons, and they would eat them on that branch, and they would drop into that cave. Right. However, the book remains, African Genesis, and it's been a bestseller. And Robert Ardrey has been one of the greatest exponents of the idea of human beings being really violent people. And that's because his own studies with animal... he studies some animals, you know, and doesn't really know anything. So we've got to be really... I mean, I think this is a really... You know, these are really interesting anecdotes, but they're so... You know, they exemplify so well the way we look at ourselves today in a given system and say, that's human nature. And, you know, and even scientists do it. Really, you know, intelligent people who study the matter. Anyway, I've gone on for long.
Yes, well, while we're on the question of violence, when we look at it, most violence is perpetrated by men. Not all, but most of it is by men. And if we look at that, I mean, are we looking at what we probably see is very, very different social conditioning images that men are subjected to, that it reinforces any sort of...
Absolutely.
Not just from your boyhood. I mean, you're all of you subject to it now.
Yeah.
No end of television and films. Man is the predator, woman is the victim.
Yeah.
And these images are being presented to you. So I think...
There's nothing more mainly mad than the press going on about rape and then showing half the stuff they do on television. I mean, they in fact manufacture it.
Yeah.
They manufacture it every damn day, and the papers themselves. And well, it's more grist for their mill, of course, because they've got something else to write about on the front page.
If violence is human nature, women would be violent as well.
Well, that's true. But what I think is amazing, in fact, considering what goes on, you know, what's on the media and what we're told, is that there's not more violence. Because when you think about it, we live in a... Well, I don't know, I'm a woman, I'm a small woman, I don't really stand much of a chance, and yet I've travelled virtually all over the world, not all over the world, but, in lots of different parts of the world, America and Europe. I've not been in any other countries but those, on my own. And I've been... sort of careful about, you know, not walking around the middle of the night and stuff. But on the whole, I feel quite safe. I feel quite safe.
I don't.
maybe not quite. Fairly safe.
And go back to this question of greed. You said that greedy are a minority.
Yeah.
Well, someone like Henry Ford, he was greedy, but as a consequence of his greed, millions of people got multi-cars, and that was an advance. It's because of this greedy minority that society does advance. And so because socialism wouldn't reward the greedy, it's stagnated.
Yeah, but I mean, look at the drawbacks. I mean, what about the you know, part of the advance with advance through greed also means wars, weapons, nuclear weapons, pollution, starvation, and all that stuff. Is it an advance? If you look at the way people lived before civilization, then, you know, I don't know. What was it? It was something that Gandhi said, which I thought was very funny. It was another speaker that came to Swansea, which gave us this quote, and apparently somebody asked Gandhi what he thought about Western civilization. And he said, sounds like a good idea. Why don't they try it? You know, and...
Well, what's socialism be, isn't it? Just not to have any initiative to...
I think you're making a mistake here. The chap behind you was talking about greed and so on. If you look at the workplace as a good example of where you're saying greed and motivation and so on, if you look at the modern management methods, for instance, they know that they don't motivate people by money. That's quite far down the list of what motivates people. It's by praising people and putting some glory onto someone. That motivates them. So surely under socialism, this is what would be happening, and you'd have that way you'd get the advances more so than under capitalism.
Who would do the motivating?
I think
we'd be motivating ourselves just like you do it in an efficiently run capitalist business.
Yeah, can I just, I'd just like to say a quick word about that, because how, you know, if you think that people are just motivated by greed, how can you account for all the voluntary activities that people go into? How can you account for
self-satisfaction? That's what motivates people.
No, but how can you? You know, when you think of people, well, when you think of people, for instance, producing plays in an amateur society, not for money, not for anything, they go to a tremendous amount of trouble and work and learning parts and all that, and it is purely, as you say, for self-satisfaction. And that's how socialism works.
Yeah, but they're calling that bad.
Well, that's bad, isn't it?
The socialists don't have these morals, you see. We don't make any moral judgments.
I mean, it's a form of greed. Well, if you like, in that case, well, no, I know what he means. I can understand. If you like, socialism would be based on greed then, but it would be based on people understanding that if they want their self-satisfaction, they shouldn't work all the time for just a tiny minority. Why should that work? I mean, the trouble today is that people aren't greedy enough. They allow a tiny minority of people to take it all, and we just work for them. So, you know, I'll go along with you and say that.